Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When Greg Cope White signed up for boot camp as a teenager, he did not fully comprehend how much it would take to get through the session. He was 14 pounds under the minimum weight requirement. He knew almost nothing about military service, and he had a secret. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The fact that White is gay might be no impediment today. In fact, it would be no impediment. But when he joined the Marines in 1979, 15 years before even Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it was something he was terrified to have discovered. Today, Greg Cope White is a television comedy writer and a blogger at Eat Greg Eat. He writes about his early experiences in the military in his new book, The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. Greg, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You admit that enlisting was a pretty rash decision, but not uncharacteristic for you at the time. You imagined, you say, that you would be dabbling in being a Marine. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, although it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me, I wasn't raised by parents who had served in the military, even grandparents. So when my best friend, who's still my best friend to this day, by the way, when he called me after our freshman year of college to tell me that he was enlisting in the Marine Corps, spending his summer in boot camp in Paris Island, and going to finish in time for our sophomore semester, all I really heard was summer and camp. I know that's funny, but it really is true. I didn't know what I was getting into.
Your parents were Mormon converts. To what extent did the faith sink into your consciousness and your sense of identity as a kid?
You know, it definitely taught me some lessons about authenticity, because here I was keeping my sexuality a secret, and I was aware of that at a pretty early age. But also, I became really aware early on that the Mormon church was a false religion. Yet, because my parents were taking me to church and I was expected to be a good little boy, I testified that it was true. I tried to act like it was true. But deep down, like our society's figuring out, like it plays on Broadway 8 shows a week in Book of Mormon, it's white trash Scientology, if you will. So I had to learn to mask that authenticity as well.
You do say in the book that you met a lot of really nice Mormons. I know we have Mormons listening. You are not a proponent of the faith, but surely you wouldn't want to insult all people who adhere to Mormonism.
And I love so many Mormons. I just don't like Mormonism.
So you had this kind of peripatetic childhood. You were moving all over. By the time you were, you know, a teenager, you had lived apart from your mom for some time. So at 18, did it just not seem to you strange to make a big decision like this without really consulting anybody first?
That's exactly right. Because I'd moved around so much, I went to 13 schools in 11 years. And because I'd never had any sense of permanence, both the decision to do something rash like join the military was easy. And also, I was looking for something to belong to. Hmm. I had nothing.
The irony is, 13 schools in 11 years sounds like a military childhood.
I know. We were not even in the military. And we weren't on the lam or anything. I think my parents just made some decisions for their own careers that didn't take the fact that there were four boys in grade school.
So you mentioned your friend Dale, your best friend, was going off to boot camp and said to you, why don't you come along? Talk a little bit about what you liked about hanging around with him and his family and what you found there that maybe wasn't always present at home.
They were the perfect TV family, even the perfect sitcom family, because his mom was half Japanese and really funny. And his dad was a really strict former Marine disciplinarian. And he had a sister, so it was a boy and a girl. They lived in a tract home, split level, and I loved going over to their house. My mom worked a lot. She went back to school and got her bachelor's and her master's and her PhD. And so we were latchkey kids. That's where I learned to cook, because I was hungry as a kid. But I loved going over to Dale's house, because to me, his house represented everything that I wanted in my life as a family.
So you guys signed up for boot camp on what was called the buddy system. What did that mean?
It means as long as you don't break the law or lose your physical capabilities, like if you pass every physical test, you're guaranteed to stay together the entire time.
And that, I guess it sounded like, well, we'll have this experience together.
It did. And I, you know, as you read in the book, I was desperate to hold on to that tie.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine getting separated and going through that.
And Dale knew that you were gay.
He did. While that may not be a normal discussion for teenagers to have in the 70s, and we didn't have deep, long discussions about that, but we were certainly comfortable with each other.
But what he didn't say was, dude, the military is not going to be okay with this.
You know, that's what's so funny. You would think that that would have been the first red flag for him to raise about my decision to, you know, want to join with him. But it wasn't. He was more concerned about the fact that I'd never run a mile. I'm from Texas. As you know, we drive to the corner. So I had never run a mile. I'd never done pull-ups or sit-ups or push-ups or anything like that. And I'd definitely never been yelled at by anyone.
Yeah. I love that, you know, you say you got off the bus and it, for the first time it occurred to you that people would be rude to you at boot camp.
Nobody tells you that part. You know, you have to also remember that this was about 6 years after the Vietnam War had ended. There was no, you know, mandatory draft yet. So the Marine Corps or any military service was a pretty hard sell at that point. The recruitment tape did not show that. So when those guys stormed on the bus and started yelling and screaming, I'd, you know, only met the really kind of car salesman Marine Corps recruiter at that point. So to have those guys, I was sat in my seat like, what the? Why are these guys talking to me like that?
Did that feel like a bait and switch at the time, in the moment?
Totally felt like a bait and switch because it's like a light switch flipping on. Suddenly the world was different. Everything that I thought I might be experiencing that summer changed in that one instance with that behavior.
And at that point, you were signed on for 6 years of reserve service, right?
I was. And 6 years with 4 years active, 2 years reserves. There was all sorts of different contracted terms that you could pick from. There were four-year terms. Everybody made deals.
So before you could even be accepted, you had the issue of weight to deal with. Your physical initially showed you needed to gain 14 pounds in 8 days, to which I say, come hang out with me between, you know, New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve and New Year's. But this was a challenge for you.
It was. You know, I know everybody has body issues. You know, I'm not saying that it's awesome to be heavier or thinner, but I know that everybody that's heavy wishes they were thin. And trust me, when I was so, so skinny as a kid, it was hard to find clothes. I didn't want to be skinny and stick out like that. But the fact that I did have to gain 14 pounds was quite the obstacle. I went into that recruitment office sort of thinking I was doing them a favor by signing up. But then when they told me that I didn't weigh enough, they said, you have 8 days to gain that weight. Dale had been on the wrestling team in high school, and he often had to gain or lose 5 pounds to go up to the next weight class. So he said, I'll help you. And he'd motivate me by eating a banana. Then I'd eat a banana. He'd eat a sandwich. I'd eat a sandwich. I must tell you, he gained 18 pounds in those 8 days and has never been upset about it with me after all these years. And not even then did he hang it over my head. And then, as you know from the book, I still had to do something extra special to gain the last 3 pounds.
Yeah. So the guy who had recruited you had some tricks up his sleeve.
He did. You know, I was I didn't know what to do. And
you're 3 pounds short when you go for your final weigh-in.
I was 3 pounds short, and we're leaving in about an hour. Our plane, we're going for the airport. And so if I failed the physical then, once again, I wouldn't go. And at this point, as you can imagine, when someone tells you you can't do something, there's something in me for sure that wants to even do it worse. So when they said you failed, you know, you're still 3 pounds shy, I thought for sure it was over. And the recruiter grabbed me by the hand, and we ran to a downtown New Orleans hardware store, and he took a lead pipe and he hammered it flat on the ground with the big sledgehammer, as flat as he could. And then he ordered me into the bathroom. I pulled down my pants and he taped it to my skin, that lead weight. And then we ran back to the same place where I had just weighed in about 20 minutes before with the same people. And you weigh in your underwear, and I waddled up to the scales and that you know, that big weight was just beating in my underwear like the telltale heart. And then, of course, the needle popped over and I made the weight. And, you know, within 8 hours, I was standing there on Paris Island with a shaved head, all in green clothes, with an M16 in my arms.
So shaved head, this was a big deal. You were fond of your hair. You know, it's funny because people think about this issue, you know, with women, but, it, you know, men can be fond of their hair as well.
I am, you know, I'm still fond of my hair. I'm thrilled just to have it. But I was a product of the 70s. You know, I had these great hair role models. That was Starsky and Hutch and the Hardy Boys and all these great hairstyles. And I rocked those feathered wings. So to have it just shaved off in a second was a bit of a shocker. I just watched it fall to the ground.
Talk a little bit about that kind of, you know, temporary loss of identity, or that, you know, for purposes of your job as a Marine, that loss of your individual identity.
I didn't understand the basic mission of the Marine Corps when I went in, for sure, as we just talked about. So I certainly wasn't aware that what they were doing was equalizing all of us. You know, everybody came in from all walks of life. We had black guys, white guys, Latin guys, Asian guys, and all of those guys have different hair, of course. So the first thing they do is shave that off. Now everybody's bald. Then they put everybody in the same camouflage uniforms. You don't get to keep any of your personal effects. So they strip you of everything that you came in with and only equip you with what they want you to have.
You brought five. Initially thought you could take along five suitcases.
I did. I'd never been away from home that long. I packed five suitcases. And you can't even take a toothbrush. I mean, come on. What if there were formal nights? I needed options.
So you know that you're gay. You know that the military is not cool with this, not least because there are a series of questions that you have to answer back in 1979.
They just asked me point blank. You know, I had never planned on having the discussion about my sexuality, maybe ever. So to have this hyper-masculine guy ask me these questions. He looked like he jumped off the recruiting poster that I was looking at, The Few, The Proud, The Marine. And to have him look me in the eyes and say, "Have you?" They didn't call it gay back then. They dragged the word out like it had 18 syllables. Are you a homosexual? And they asked me that. I said, no. They asked me again. They asked me again, have you ever had any homosexual thoughts? I'm looking at that guy thinking, I'm having one right now. But I certainly was not prepared to answer that question. And I lied about that and again, thought that I had made it through just based on being able to convince him of that. Then, of course, the physical came that I failed.
I love what you say, which is that you lied with conviction that you didn't yet understand. Can you explain that to us?
That gets back to that idea of authenticity. You know, it wasn't safe to be in the military as an out person until President Obama repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It isn't safe in our society today, in a lot of places, to be an open gay man, open gay person. I live in Los Angeles. I'm from Dallas, where it's a very liberal town, LA. I get to walk around with confidence and be myself. But it wasn't always like that for me. And it's certainly not like that for everyone else. So I spent a lot of time acting not gay, not just as a Marine, but as an actor, as a person interviewing for a job. You never know what someone's gonna hold against you.
My guest is Greg Cope White. His new book, it's a memoir, is called The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with blogger and TV comedy writer Greg Cope White. His new memoir is called The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Had you been messed with as a kid, as a teenager, by people who suspected that you were gay?
I was. I think because I was little, I was even an easier target. Mm-hmm. I'd always feared and felt that, I don't know, feared was the wrong word there. I'd always felt that I looked rather feminine. I was little, I had these big round blue eyes, and I was skinny. And so I often thought that I already looked feminine, and that was sort of a natural thing for people to pick on. I was littler than everybody else. By the time I got to ninth grade, I was barely 5 feet tall, and a lot of the guys were almost 6 feet tall. And I was very intimidated by just their physical size. I used humor. I tried to be really funny, including laughing when jokes were made about me. My nickname was Cambodia Legs because my legs were so skinny. I didn't participate in team sports because I certainly didn't want to wear gym shorts. And so I became someone who, you know, used self-deprecating humor at a really early age.
Were you aware of cultivating your sense of humor as a defense mechanism, or did you look back and realize, oh, this is a big reason that I'm funny?
I was pretty aware that it got a good reaction from people.
Uh-huh.
It felt great to make people laugh. It made me feel like they weren't going to beat me up, and it made me feel accepted. When I made people laugh, they, you know, wanted to have me around, or they'd, you know, I loved to befriend the acting groups. I did theater and stuff like that when I was in school. And that sort of became my tribe. But because I moved around so often, those were groups that I would seek out and get in a play or get in a show. But the fact that I was also constantly trying to sit back and look at my life and where I was going to fit in, that was a constant, I was constantly gathering material. I wanted to be different. I wanted to be better.
And then you get to boot camp and discover that it's run by bullies, or at least people who are playing at being bullies in service to the training.
God, I've never met anybody as mean and bullyish as my drill instructors. Mm. And technically they were my comrades. Once boot camp was over, you're not treated like a recruit anymore. You're treated with respect by those same guys. I didn't know that then. I thought that was how they just were going to be forever. But I was yelled at and screamed at. I was called a faggot to my face, just as everybody else was. But when you really are one, that name sticks a little harder.
I have to say, you know, reading this book, Greg, I had understood that being gay was against the rules in the military for a long time. And I can understand how frightening it must be to worry you'll be discovered. I hadn't had a clear sense of how openly and grossly homophobic the culture was. The chants you ran to in 1979, the insults instructors threw out there to get people moving are entirely based around the idea that anybody not performing well must therefore be gay.
Yeah, don't you hate that was the easiest word and the easiest slur to pull?
Yeah. I don't know what would be a better slur. They're all horrible, but I can't imagine how demoralizing that must have felt.
Yeah, and like I said, for me, every time I heard that, I just thought for sure they were talking to me, for sure that they knew, for sure that my secret was out. I had to watch how I reacted, how I flinched my eyes, and how I made sure that they didn't see that I was really insulted or hurt. I just kept my head down and worked as hard as everyone else.
The first time you practiced firing an M16, your greatest fear of all things to be afraid of was that you would react in a way that sort of labeled you as effeminate.
Can you imagine? It has tremendous recoil and power, that M16. And I'd certainly watched people firing it and saw the recoil, and I thought, please don't let me scream like a girl. First off, I was also still really small and really skinny. I was a little concerned that my own physical mass wouldn't hold up to it and wouldn't have the proper stance to be the right force against that gun, against that rifle. So I was, and then you have headphones on. I just talked about being self-reflective. Talk about being self-reflective. Shut all the world out around you and then have every thought that you need to do. And that was what we were there for, to train to fire that weapon effectively.
And you were struck by the idea that, like, okay, I'm being trained potentially to kill here if I'm ever in a war zone.
That's their basic job. Their basic job is to take young men and women and within 3 months train them against our basic instinct, which is to kill, which is to murder.
Yeah, what do you, I mean, I don't know that you're encouraged to spend a lot of time reflecting on this sort of thing when you're in the middle of basic training or even after, but it is a strange process for anyone to go through and a necessary one for a certain segment of our society. But this idea that you are taught in very short order to kind of set aside all the cultural and moral taboos we have against killing.
All in the name of our country. Mm-hmm. My level of patriotism rose, and it's still extremely high. I love our country. Sure, I got paid to defend it, but I'll defend it for the rest of my life for free. It all of the negative and the yelling and the screaming and the weird things that I had to go through, if anything, if that awoke the patriotism that I love and cherish, I'm all for it.
Did you ultimately form a different relationship to, you know, gay slurs that were thrown at you? Did you learn to not hear them in quite the same way?
No, they still sting. One of the reasons you read this about one of the reasons I wrote the book was because as the stories of young gays and lesbians across the country and the world being victims of bullying, when those stories came to the surface a few years ago, I had to write this book. I wanted to show all of those kids that were choosing to end their lives that it does get better. If I can make it through the Marine Corps, if I can make it through that, anybody can make it through anything. And we have to stick, but we have to stick to it. We have to stand by.
You had to manage, at least in theory, the possibility of being attracted to your fellow recruits. But what you write here is really instructive. I was a 19-year-old gay man, so of course there were a few I found cute and some I found incredibly hot. But just as if we were in the civilian world, I didn't let my eyes linger. I wanted to get out of boot camp with status as a Marine, not with telephone numbers.
Right. That was the furthest thing from my mind, not only because it was such a pressure cooker of a situation, but and we're also kept extremely busy. I had no intention of having sex when I was in boot camp, flirting with anybody. I wanted to do my job. And if my job entailed that for some bizarre reason, I'd do it. But no part of my job description had that in it.
Does it bother you that for a long time, many people seem to assume that you couldn't possibly be functional in that job without constantly thinking about sex?
Yes, it does. You know, we have a bigger job at hand. Everything is at stake. We are here to defend our country against horrible enemies. And I guarantee you, when I meet other Marines and have these discussions with other military members, whether former or current, we all agree. That's not our big fear. I have been supported, and as you read in the book, I felt this amazing sense of camaraderie, not just in boot camp, but it went on to officer candidate school. And I cherish those memories and those relationships that I had with all those guys.
You came to feel like Paris Island was home in a really fundamental way.
You know, it was weird to leave. I was happy to go to the next stage, to graduate. But looking as I packed up for the final time and looked around at that squad bay, I knew right then that this was the first place that I had ever felt a sense of belonging to. And oddly enough, it was the barest, most unattractive home I'd ever lived in.
I want to talk about getting yourself through the physical challenges, because this is, you know, even for people who maybe come out of high school and they've been star athletes, this is intended to be very difficult training. I mean, it must have been really daunting in the beginning when, as you say, you know, just 3 pull-ups were a real challenge for you.
Yeah, I'd never done a pull-up. I didn't even know what that was. Again, because I'd never been in gym class a day in my life. I'd never done a run, a sprint, or anything like that. And to ask my, thank God I was 18 when I went in, but to ask my body to do all those things was bizarre and insane. I had several injuries, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have time to recover because they're simulating a battle situation. Were I to break a little bone in battle, I'd have to keep going. You have to keep going day after day after day. And so all of those early attempts and struggles and discoveries about my body, all the sore muscles, I don't know if everybody had those. Some people go in pretty good shape, by the way.
There was the moment when you realized your body was changing. It was doing all these things you were asking of it with relative ease.
You know, I started because when I would go into the group showers, which were several, you know, at least two a day, I was very ashamed of my body. I didn't want anybody to look at my body, which was flat and skinny and weak, and I didn't have any chest hair. I still don't, which I always thought was the definition of masculinity. By
and
the
now
way.
That's like course, the thing, right? You'd be waxing it if
now
you
hairy hadn't. Guys are shaving their chests. But yeah, so I went in there and just totally ashamed. But then after even just a few weeks of all of that exercise, you know, you exercise nonstop, not just the official exercise where you're training on the ground, on the parade deck and marching, but you're punished with physical training about 18 hours of the day. So I was starting to build up, and I, you know, when I would rub soap across my body, I noticed there was a couple of bumps in my chest, and I saw the biceps on my arms forming. That was exciting. I literally felt like I was becoming the man that I'd always dreamed of.
Was there someone from your previous life that you wanted to witness all these changes in yourself?
I was most proud of having Dale with me. You know, mm-hmm. he's still the most constant person in my life. We've been best friends since we were 13. And, you know, we both live in L.A. now. So I'm around him all the time. I definitely wanted to make him proud. He took a big risk going in with me. You know, here he was. Everybody knew that he was in there on the buddy system with me. Were my secret found out, they'd accuse him of something.
I want to talk about the consequences of that secret because obviously you could have been kicked out and dishonorably discharged, and it would have been humiliating. What was the thing that caused you to fear being discovered? Because theoretically, and I don't mean to minimize this, but theoretically, you'd have been kicked out and nobody, you know, you could have moved somewhere else and nobody would have even known that you went to boot camp. Can you talk about why it felt so fundamentally frightening that someone might find out this thing about you that at the time was perceived to be something that you should be ashamed of?
Yeah, the first thing and the most important, the most urgent thing that I always feared was getting beaten up, getting hit by my fellow recruits, getting hit by a drill instructor, being, you know, accused and beaten in private, dragged into a locker or a closet or a shower. And that was my biggest fear. As a gay teenager, I came in with that fear. That was my fear all of my life. I'd been slammed against lockers in school. I'd been picked on. I'd been shoved to the ground and yelled names at. But now I was in this pressure cooker situation where I couldn't go home. I was home. There was nowhere to run. I didn't know to trust the drill instructors or anybody if someone were to attack me. I was really afraid for being physically hurt.
Did you worry about sexual assault?
I didn't. I didn't. That's a good question.
And I guess back then people didn't know that it happened to men in the military or even so much that it happened to women in the military.
Yeah. And I know it is a big problem. I hope that it's getting easier. I heard Vice President Biden's speech at the Oscars about rape on campus, and that's quite moving and horrible. I hope that statistic lowers and we clear that problem up. But I don't know why it didn't happen in my platoon. Perhaps it happens in other platoons. I'm glad it didn't happen.
So, Greg, it turns out you were a really good Marine.
Who'd have thunk? But I, you know, that's where I found my calling. I had a great time. You know, one of the reasons that the book got bought was because it was the first gay memoir, military memoir, that didn't denigrate the military. Because that's not my experience. I have friends that were drummed out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they were just accused. But I had so much great experience that I gained in that. You know, I'm proud to have that on my resume. There's lessons that I use every day from that training. And I kicked ass.
Was there something, you know, as you started to be recognized for being actually better than some of your fellow recruits? I mean, I wonder how it changed your self-esteem and your image of who you were.
That's definitely bringing water to a simmer and not a boil as far as self-confidence. Mm-hmm. Because I had none at all, and I guess I was, think of me as a pot of cold water going in. And then when I would get a little confidence or achieve something or pass something, the water would heat up a little bit. And probably by, you know, just a few times, my pot came to a boil in boot camp.
Do you think anybody suspected in hindsight?
Yes, I do. I think the drill instructor that I write the most about, Santoro, mm-hmm. I think he knew. I think he was a great man. I think he saw potential in me, even though we butted heads. And that relationship, to me, is the most fascinating relationship in the book. And but I definitely think that he either suspected or just assumed, but saw enough potential in me by like week six to support me.
Tell us more about him.
You know, he was the ideal man. I said before that I always pictured that the ideal masculine guy had a hairy chest and 5 o'clock shadow. That was him. Santoro was the perfect physical specimen of a man. His sexuality was almost threatening. And again, like I just mentioned, I didn't want to sleep with him or date him. I wanted to be him. Mm-hmm. And he was so in such good shape and maybe a little show off. He would smoke cigarettes as he ran in formation training. But he had a great sense of humor. He was very philosophic. I wanted to be that guy.
We're speaking this hour with author Greg Cope White. His new memoir is called The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with television comedy writer and blogger Greg Cope White. His new memoir is called The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Greg, to think about, you know, there are so many people now who are veterans who we find out later, you know, they joined before it was legal to be gay or lesbian in the military, and now we know that there have been people serving honorably. I wonder if there have also been people like Santoro who have known that there were people who had the potential to serve honorably, turning a blind eye over the years.
I certainly hope so, because first off, you know, speaking from my own experience, I was there to do a job, and I certainly wanted the right to do that job as long as I perform my duties within the guidelines of the job. But the people that I know that were kicked out through no fault of their own, other than the fact that they were gay, lost their careers. Their lives were changed, often ruined, and here they were volunteering and wanting to serve their country. I strongly believe that we've moved in a huge right direction by ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Do you happen to know if boot camp is still full of homophobic chants and march songs?
It is. I spoke at I did a book reading in Miami this weekend, and there's a great group out there called Marine Moms, and some of them were there, and they love reading about the book because it makes the letters that they're receiving from their sons in boot camp make sense. Because I'm you know, obviously they've got a page to write their story, and I've got 300, They told me that they still do use those slurs and that everything is just as rough and crazy and homophobic.
What did it feel like over time, over those 13 weeks of boot camp, as other people started dropping out and you realized that you were making it?
That was a huge shock to me. I totally, you know, every day, minute by minute, I was constantly afraid that I was going to get kicked out. So as other guys were dropped, I was just flabbergasted that that wasn't me. I felt badly for them, maybe even a little more empathetic, because I realized, wow, that should have been me. But I also started to feel a sense of pride when I kept up physically, or I fired the rifle well, or I swam really well.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Bill on the line in Plano. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I was just thinking about Greg. I went into the Navy in 1943, Greg. I wasn't gay. In fact, I knew nothing about sex. I was so naive. But I went in to have my interview, and the guy said, "Do you like boys or girls?" And I said, "Well, it depends on what we're going to do," which was not a good answer.
That's not a good answer.
And it continued on, and finally he wrote down the question mark on my form and sent me out, and a friend of mine came by with the same look on his face like, "What are they doing?" I said, "I don't know. I have no idea what they want." But I went in to see a professor-type guy, and he said, "Do you ever kiss a girl?" I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Okay, go on in." So I can imagine. That was confusing to me. I can imagine your dilemma being in that service. But I, like you, love the Navy. I would have stayed in, but I didn't for other reasons. And I've enjoyed listening to you and can really sympathize as a straight person what you almost get into in the service. But it was a lot of fun to listen to you. I'm glad you've come out so well.
Bill,
thank you,
sir.
And thank you for your service. You know, you bring up a good point. I'm the only gay guy in the book. As Chris knows, the story, I get to tell the story of 70 other guys who, as far as I know in the book, are all straight. So the book's just a little gay.
You know, it must have been gratifying as time went on and you realized that you hadn't been alone. Right, because it didn't occur to you that anyone else around you might be gay, right?
Right. I didn't. I have a series of stories coming up for the next book about the time that it was just the week after boot camp that I started dating my first Marine. And that came out of the blue. So, no, I certainly did not plan on that. I thought I was alone and special and definitely not going to meet another me in the Marine Corps.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Nita on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Nita.
That was my grandmother's name.
Oh, very nice.
Hi, Greg. I'm your grandmother.
Oh, hi, Nita.
Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for this. This is just an amazing conversation. And I was in the military. I've been out for probably about 30 years now. So it's been a while. And, of course, back then you didn't tell. And I had several friends who were gay and lesbian. And I think about all of what it takes to train people for their jobs. I had one friend who was an Arab linguist who they took through school. I mean, he was an amazing Arab linguist. And when he was found out, they discharged him, dishonorable discharge immediately. So I was wondering if you could speak to the cost and the loss to the military when someone who is so highly trained like yourself is dishonorably discharged just because of being gay or lesbian.
Thanks for that story. I'm very sorry for your friend. First off, that's a huge loss to our country, especially in the political climate that we live in, that linguist was dishonorably discharged. Let's talk about the cost. Let's talk about the cost to the government, which they just invested a lot of money, maybe even on legal fees, to drum that person out, to train that person, then drum them out. But let's talk about it, what cost that individual. I mentioned earlier that I'm so proud to be able to put the United States Marine Corps on my resume. If I didn't have an honorable discharge, I wouldn't be able to put that on my resume. So that, your friend, is unable to put that on their resume, and that might float their resume to the top. That's horrible.
Have you gained any understanding, as society is moving in a different direction, of why for a long time the majority of people perhaps, and today maybe a minority, but they're still there, are afraid of, you know, men and women among them who are attracted to those of the same sex?
I certainly, you know, don't understand it. I'll tell you, I'm so blessed to have people in my life like Dale and a very accepting family that just get it right away. I don't know what they're so afraid of. You know, I have friends that are comedians like Scott Silverman and Georgia Ragsdale that have jokes in their acts like, you know, what are they afraid of, that they're going to buy a belt and shoes that match? I don't get it. You know, I look at myself and my friends and the way that I live my life. I try to make a positive contribution to our society. And I certainly don't want to be reduced to just my sexuality.
So when you were in boot camp and being addressed by slurs, because everybody was being addressed by gay slurs, you were frightened that you would be found out, that somebody would discover this and you would be humiliated. How long did it take for you to be angry that that was the language that everybody trafficked in?
I was angry constantly. I was insulted every time they said that, but I was also afraid that they were talking about me, of course, and that I could get kicked out. So it wasn't until after boot camp that I really was able to feel those feelings and be really upset that that was the common denominator that they kept going to.
Let's go
it's
back.
Too easy.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Phil on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Phil.
When you were being interviewed the first time, was there any thought that this gentleman that was interviewing you was what he was asking you? And how many people did you ran into as leadership trainers were possibly the same way that you were, that you may not have known at the time?
Phil, I didn't think that the recruiter was possibly also gay at all. I you know, he had a pretty clear-cut job to do, which was to filter out undesirables, for lack of a better word. And if being gay was against the law at that point, then that certainly put me in that class. I didn't get the feeling that he was asking me out at all.
I love, you know, you talk about the fact that today you will meet people and sometimes, I guess, surprise them by saying, oh, yeah, I'm a Marine veteran. What is that like? And are there times when you know that you can, that you will surprise somebody by revealing this about yourself?
Chris, it happened this weekend. I have a show on Food Network's cooking channel. Mm-hmm. I'm on a show called Unique Sweets. And I was just in Miami last week for the South Beach Food and Wine Festival, which is sponsored by Food Network. And I was at one party and I met one of the big executives from the network who I didn't know. And he found out about the book and found out that I was a Marine. And about an hour later, I was at the Versace Mansion, which was so cool. About an hour later, he comes running up to me and pulls me out of the area that I was in and said, there's another Marine here. I want you to go talk to him and meet him. And I'm happy to. So I did. And I met this Marine who was a representative from a food company that advertises on the network. And of course, he looks like the poster of the Marine Corps. The great square jaw, still had the haircut. And like I say in the book, within 30 seconds, we had a conversation about shared experiences, shared memories, all the likes, all the dislikes. And I watched that network executive possibly go from not believing that I was really a Marine to being totally convinced, because here I was with this guy who looked the part. I'm totally pleased to not look like anybody else and to be an individual. I'm proud that I get to live that way.
I don't know how often you recommend to some young person that you meet, gay or straight, you know, a career in military service. And I wonder if that's changed along with shifts in the laws affecting who's allowed to perform military service.
Are you asking if I would recommend it as a job to someone?
And did you recommend it before bans on service of gays and lesbians were lifted?
No, I would not have recommended it to anybody that was gay. I didn't want them to possibly fail, to possibly be kicked out or booted out. I was seeing that too often. Would I recommend it today? Absolutely. What a great time we live in. You know, going back to that thought about authenticity. What a great time to go in and be proud and do a great job, because that's the area that you want to be. That's where you want to be of service.
How did your fitness plan sort of, you write about the fact that you're the perfect example of someone who didn't start out life as someone who was really that into working out, and boot camp kind of changed everything for you.
Yeah, I did a Spartan race last year, and I must admit I didn't train heavily before it. And I relied on everything that I had learned when I was running through some of the Marine Corps drills to push me through that completion. But it definitely instilled in me a physical fitness program that I do forever. I can still do pull-ups. I can still do sit-ups. I'm getting a little too bony in the knees and hips to run like I used to. It turns out I was built to run. When you're tall and thin, you run like the wind.
What about the mental training that you learned? You know, you write about the first, is it called a force march? And they get you up in the middle of the night and you go for, you're not sure how long.
Yeah, and that definitely pays off in the future too. They wake you up and disorient you, and everybody has to carry the same weight, and you're carrying a backpack, and you're force marched out into the field where you spend 72 hours trying to accomplish goals and be in situations to show that you've understood and successfully completed your training, everything you've trained on for the first 3 months. I use that today. I can pop out of bed like toast. I have a heavy travel schedule, even with this book tour. I don't need an alarm clock. I'm up. I'm ready to go. Once you've had a drill instructor bang garbage cans in your ears to wake you up, you don't need an alarm clock.
There's lots of ways you could have told even your own story. What made you decide to use kind of a light touch? You don't gloss over the things that, you know, frightened you and that were really challenging within your personal life and also at boot camp. But you clearly want to sort of pull us in with laughter here.
It was important for me to tell this story with humor, not just because, like we talked about, I've been kind of trying to be funny my whole life. But I really wanted to use comedy and humor. It took me a while to write this book because it takes a while after you've been in such an intense and possibly tragic situation to find the humor in it.
Hmm.
What Chaplin had a quote, I'm probably going to paraphrase, but it's life is a tragedy when seen close up, but a comedy in long shot.
When did you realize that this was a comedy and not a tragedy? Was it years after you were done?
I knew the minute I taped that lead weight to my crotch that I had a story.
Well, I'm glad after all these years that you have told it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Greg Cope-White is a comedy writer and TV host and a blogger at Eat Greg Eat. His new memoir is called The Pink Marine, One Boy's Journey Through Boot Camp to Manhood. Greg, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for spending this time with us.
You're welcome. Have a great day, Chris. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.